continue the discussion on this topic.
Now, today we are going to explain one very important aspect of karma yoga or spiritual life in general. How do we turn to spiritual life? How do we suddenly start thinking of something that goes beyond the empirical, beyond the immediate problems of today, and try to look for some higher spiritual transcendental values? It could happen in so many ways. Sometimes even very intelligent, extremely elevated, evolved people also may require some compelling circumstances to turn to spiritual life. So I am going to place, to begin with, a narrative of a very, very great emperor, a king, who by mistake happened to commit a sinful deed, and then how he happened to turn to spiritual life. The name of that king mentioned in the Bhagavata Purana is Parikshit. Incidentally, he was the grandson of Arjuna. His name is Parikshit. So it is stated that during that time it was a huge empire extending many regions beyond today's Indian subcontinent. So one day he was hunting in the forest. In those days, it was the duty of kings and emperors to keep peace and harmony, not only in society but also in forest. In today's terms, one may question why this king was going about hunting animals in the forests. So there are many important conventions that kings had to follow in those days, ancient times. There will be sages and hermits doing meditation in the forest regions. Sometimes there will be evildoers trying to disturb them. You may have read in mythological books, like, you know, the demons, the asuras, the rakshasas, trying to disturb peace in society, especially trying to disturb spiritual practices of devotees. That was their favorable pastime. To go about looking for places where people are meditating or singing hymns in praise of the Lord. So how to create problems? So some of the devices they used to employ were very funny. They will take the dirt and filth and excrete and pour in the hermitages. The hermits won't be able to do anything. They had to go through the elaborate process of cleaning up the whole place, Ganga water, Ganges water, to start their spiritual practices all over again. So these sort of things are mentioned in the mythological books. Anyway, so it was the duty of a king to look for such evildoers in forest, and also wild animals. Who used to, when the wild elephants, for example, herds of elephants stampeding and destroying hermitages. So it was the duty of kings to save the hermits from these disturbances. So this king was going about looking for such evildoers, wild animals. So he became so tired and exhausted one day, having traveled long distances. And he found a small hermitage in the thick of the forest. And he entered the place. And there he saw an old man with a long beard, a great sage, sitting in meditation, absorbed in meditation, contemplation. He did not know that king had entered hermitage, maybe looking for drinking water. That's what he was looking for. He was hungry and thirsty. You can remember in this, the terrible summer of the Indian subcontinent. So the king thought this old man was sitting there pretending to be absorbed in meditation and he didn't greet him, he did not offer him drinking water. This normally would not happen to him. He was so well known, had such a high reputation for nobility, for propriety, for wisdom as an administrator, as a king. But this also shows that sometimes those who are not reached the highest level of spiritual perfection, even hunger and thirst and physical problems could disturb your mind, can prompt us to do things that we normally would not do. So he was angry. And when he was hungry and thirsty, it's very easy to get angry. So he went about, he looked around, he wanted to teach this sage a lesson. And he found a dead snake lying about, and he lifted that snake with his bow and then put it in the neck of this sage. And he went away. So this is the first part of the story. After some time, something else happened. His son, a little boy, was playing with other children of sages. You have to remember, of course, it should be mentioned in this context. Sages were not all mendicants. They were not. They were not monks. In fact, many of these great writings, many teachers of the ancient Vedic age, were not all. All of them were not monks. They were mostly very wise men or wise women, as Gargi. You know, yesterday we were reading that Maitreyi Brahmanam, the dialogue between a very enlightened husband and an equally enlightened wife. Because to ask the question, do you think this money could bring immortality in my life? I mean, can make me wise spiritually? Yeah, in that case, no. So there were great enlightened women and also enlightened men in those days. Women also studied the Vedas. They also had equal participation in all Vedic rituals. They'll be surprised. In modern times, you know, it's very difficult to get women ordained as bishops and archbishops. We don't expect an age in which women can become the Pope. It's a remote possibility. But in those days, during Vedic times, in later eras in Indian history, women were equally learned and enlightened in Vedas, in religious ceremonies. They were equal participants in Vedic heritage. In fact, well, to dive on this idea as a maybe slightly a diversion, one of the hymns in Rigveda Samhita is called Vivaha Sutta, which is a hymn chanted as part of the marriage ceremony. The 15th sacrament, one of the most important sacraments in the Vedic tradition. So, Grinnamiti Saubhagatvaya Hastam, a famous statement. So, there, the husband and wife were equal participants in the spiritual journey. Equal participants. So, what I want to tell you was, these sages were not necessarily monks. They were great monks, but not all of them. So mostly those who studied the Vedas when they were young, then endured the life of an householder, and then after several years of leading life as householders, both husband and wife would retire to the forest hermitage and spend the rest of their lifetime in contemplation and meditation. So Manusmriti makes a point. He says, Grihaspasya Vidapasya Vali Paridamatmanaga Apatyasya Apatyam Tada Aranyam Samasri. Manu was the great lawgiver of Vedic times. So he says, an householder, when he sees that his hair is getting grey, or when his face is getting wrinkled, should retire to forest hermitage. In modern times, let us say, a retirement home where you can spend the rest of the lifetime in contemplation and meditation, instead of going to places where you struggle to reverse the metabolism by trying to blacken the hair and whiten the teeth. So these so householders used to retire to lonely hermitages, and there they spent the rest of their lifetime in contemplation and meditation. And a much more important work, they used to spend their time teaching the Vedas. So many of these great philosophical ideas emerged in the forest hermitages of these old men and women who had a happy family life. And when they saw the face of their son, apatyasi apatya means when they see the face of the son, the son of the son means it's a granddaughter or grandson, which guarantees that the family lineage will be preserved. So when your hair gets grey, when the face gets wrinkled, and when you see the face of your grandson or granddaughter, depending upon the case, you should not stay at home, becoming a pest for the next generation. And what you should do, with the blessings in your face, you should voluntarily withdraw yourself from a place where the rest of the lifetime will be spent in contemplation and meditation, and a much more important work, teaching the spiritual literature. So you find, if you read the Brihadaranyaka, Chandogya, Prashnavanishad, you find Prashnavanishad, the Pippalada, a great bearded old sage sitting in the Himalayan hermitage. Six disciples come from all over Indian subcontinent. There is a prince, there is an emperor, there is also a very ordinary person. There is a young, very young boy, and also a middle-aged person. So six of them come to this sage Pippalada and ask questions. And these six questions and the six answers which the great sage constitute what's called Prashna Upanishad. Prashna means question. So six questions and six answers. So what I'm going to now coming back to the story. So this sage's son was playing nearby with other children. The sage's name was Chamiga, the little boy's name, his son's name was Srinki. So another boy came running. See, I went to your home, your hermitage, that's home. I found your father sitting there, absorbed in meditation, with a dead snake, a stinking dead snake on his neck, on his hanging dead neck. This little boy was shocked, his son. He rushed his hermitage, he found what was happening. A dead snake, stinking snake, lying on the neck of his father. He got terribly angry. So he entered the nearby river, took some water, and uttered a mantra, sacred mantra, and cursed the one, anyone who may be, who has done this heinous sin. This is the next part of the story. Now you may ask the question, why the little boy did that? His love for his father and righteous indignation at the heinous crime that you didn't know it was Parikshit who had done it, but was insulted at his old father, the harmless man sitting in meditation. Now after some time the sage opened his eyes, and then he came to know what had happened. He became very much very sad. He scolded the little boy, the son. Why did you curse that person? I know it was the king who has done this. He had this spiritual insight to understand who must have done this heinous, sinful deed. Then he scolded the boy, you should not have done it. The king was a very enlightened person, but in an unguarded moment, when he was hungry and thirsty, he may have done this. He did not deserve this curse. So what he did, he sent his other disciples to the king to inform him, look here, my ignorant son unfortunately has put a curse on you. Now what was the curse? The little boy cursed the king to die on the seventh day, bitten by a poisonous snake. Takshara is the king of the snake in the mythological literature. This terrible snake will come and bite you on the seventh day. That was the curse the little boy had put on the king's head, without of course knowing that it was the king who had done this. Now, how the king responded to this curse, that's the most important part of the story. In fact, this is a prelude to the Bhagavata Purana, the most famous and most important devotional classic in Vedantic tradition. It's called Bhagavata Purana with 12 books, each having a number of chapters. So, the king came to know from the sages' messengers that somebody has put a curse on him. He said, I deserve it. Because I did something very sinful. An innocent, enlightened sage meditating, and he did not know I had endured his hermitage. He did not offer me drinking water. And in a very unguarded moment, I would put a dead snake on his neck. So I deserve this punishment. So he knew that he had only 7 days to live. 7 into 24 hours. What he did, not withdraw all the money from the bank and spend the rest of the lifetime in enjoyment. What he did, he decided that he should leave his kingdom, his comforts, and he crowned his oldest son, Jinamejaya, as the next king apparent, and he left his kingdom, his comforts, his palace, his ministers off. So when other sages came to know the spiritual wisdom of the sage, of this king, who did not get angry at the sage or his son who cursed him, but rather took it as a punishment that he deserved, and he wanted to convert that curse into a blessing. What did he? He said, the rest of my lifetime, 7 days, I shall spend in contemplation and meditation. I will have nothing to do with the world. So he retired and went to the banks of Ganga and sat there in meditation. And when other sages came to know of what was happening, they all wanted to see this enlightened king, including the great sage whose son had cursed him. Among these sages who assembled on the banks of Ganga to see the king, there was one great sage whose name was Shuka, who is the teacher of the Bhagavata Purana. So when the Parikshit, when this king Parikshit saw Shuka himself among the assembled sages, he put one question to Shuka: what should a dying man do? Suppose you have only a few days to live. How will you face that problem? So, atat pucchami samsiddhim yoginam paramam gurum purusa seha yatkarim mriyamanasi sarvata. So, now look here, you see, I am going to ask you a question. What is the question? What should a dying man do? So, he elaborates his question. Yat kartavyam, yas martavyam, yat japyam, etc. What should I do? How should I meditate? Whom I should meditate upon? How I should practice my duties with perfect attachment as a karma yoga? Tena tyaktena gunji thaga yichavasya gunshu says. It's a commentary. The whole episode is a commentary on that particular aspect, yichavasya gunshu. So, these questions were put to the sage by the king. In answer to this question, in the next chapter, the sage Shuka starts his exposition of this spiritual classic, devotional classic called Bhagavata Purana. And he begins his instruction like this. Now, one more aspect. When the king put this question to the sage, he not only asked, what should a dying man do, but also what he should not do. Bruhi yadva viparyayam. he says, and what he should not do. So, yat kartavyam, yas martavyam, how he should go about doing his duties and responsibilities. When you are informed, when you come to know that you have only 7 days to live. In fact, those 7 days, how we live for 7 days, should be a commentary on maybe 90 years of his previous life. I mean, that will show where we have reached in our spiritual evolution. And he also asked what he should not do, how he should not go about living. In answer to this, the sage Sukha says, Etavan Sankhya Yoga Abhyam Sudharma Parinishthaya Janma Labha Parapum Samante Narayana Smriti. This is the verse. It literally means, let's expand it. You should be able to leave this world not with irritation or complaint, but remembering God. God's name in your lips and God's form in your heart. And your thoughts surrendered to God. So, Ante Narayana Smriti means at the end of your life, you should be able to remember the highest transcendental spiritual truth. If a Christian can remember Christ and His Annunciation, he can recite Sermon on the Mount. A Buddhist can perhaps recite the 26th Varga of the Dhammapada. You know, Dhammapada in Buddhist scripture, this is part of the Sutta Pitaka. It almost runs parallel to Bhagavad Gita in many places. Where Buddha says, Tam Bhuhi Brahmanam. This is Pali language. In Sanskrit means Tam Bhuhi Brahmanam. So, Brahmana, which is the word, a spiritually enlightened person. Not somebody belonging to a caste or anything. But a spiritually enlightened person. Who is a spiritually enlightened person? So Buddha, the Dhammapada expounds this very elaborately. He should be serene, should be balanced. He should be able to do his duties and responsibilities with perfect non-attachment, without any desire for just material comforts as an offering to the Lord. Offering for the good of humanity, of course, in Buddhist language. There is no God there. So the whole point is, you find these ideas in many world spiritual literature. The most relevant point in the answer given by the sage is Sudharma Parinishthaya. Sudharma Parinishthaya means what? Doing your duty. It may be that we are teachers or professors, we are factory workers, whatever may be a profession. Do that work with all focus, concentration and attention. And there it ends. Then look the other way. The ability to look the other way means looking beyond this work. That alone enables you to look, to do that work properly. If you are obsessed with the work, you won't be able to do it properly. Anxiety, obsession, worry, complaints, all these problems will take away a large portion of our energy and focus and concentration. On the other hand, if we can do all our duties and responsibilities, but eyes looking at a higher goal, then what happens, you know, when we are linked to a higher idea, tena tektena bujjitha in the first verse of Isavasya Upanishad. If we be able to link ourselves to this higher transcendental ideal, only if we realize that there is a higher transcendental spiritual truth, Isharvasini Gamsava, means the whole world is enveloped by the Divine Spirit. So, this is the instruction that Sukha gave to Parikshit. And Parikshit died as an intelligent man. It means what? He could leave his body behind with a smile in his face and with God's thoughts in his heart. Now, this could happen many ways. I was mentioning some time back. all of us sometimes have to confront with some great universal spiritual truths. It's natural. It often happens. We can't help it. Even as it is school children or ordinary people, when they are faced with certain problems, suddenly our mind goes beyond empirical, beyond today, beyond the visible things. But then that becomes only a momentary, a temporary phenomenon. If you ask the manager of the crematorium, he has every scope to become an Aristotle, but it didn't happen. Because every day he is experiencing the reality of the perishable nature of the body. But that may not necessarily convince him of the imperishable nature that remains intact even the body perishes. This is happening, you know, there's a verse in Sanskrit. Ahanyahanni bhudani gacchanti hai yamalayam tesha thavaram icchanti kim aacharyam adapayam. The verse is very, very interesting. One of the greatest wonders in the world is this. Every day, every moment, living creatures, bhudani means any living creature, not only human beings, insects, bacteria, ants, everything. They go back to the abode of death. But still, even on the face of this, we somehow feel we are going to remain for all time. Intellectually we know, everyone knows that. Even a child will know, kindergarten boy will know, that this body is not going to remain for, at least in an intellectual way. But that conviction doesn't translate into spiritual wisdom. When that conviction becomes spiritual wisdom, then we can link ourselves to Tyaga, renunciation, the higher transcendental idea. So, what is important is to keep this in mind, not that we should become skeptical or pessimistic. That's the very opposite of Vedanta. Vedanta is a science of optimism. Vedanta is a science of hope. Optimism is a great promise. It doesn't scare us with death. Actually, Vedanta is perhaps the only religious philosophy that tells you that there is no death for you. So death is only a transition point. So, you know, there is an interesting verse here, which is which is a very famous statement, you know. It says, we are always faced with the problem of fear. So, it's called bhoge roga bhayam. I mean, if we have plenty of money, wealth, then we are afraid, well, we may fall sick. So, we may fall sick, we may go for treatment, but that should not make us scary of it. See, there will be problems in life. The problems are part of the game of human life. That is the philosophy of Vedanta. One should not imagine that Vedanta solves all physiological medical problems. In fact, one disciple of Swami Vivekananda, he was so foolish, there is no better word to use, that's why. Swami Vivekananda fell sick once or twice. And this fellow was terribly upset. If he is a Vedantin, why should he fall sick? He is immortal. He is eternal. And he deserted Swami Vivekananda. Practically, he did something the opposite of what a disciple should do. Now, this is something very funny. Not only funny, it is quite... there are much better adjectives to use, which I won't use. How can you associate immortality or eternal nature with a physical body? If Christ was one of the greatest spiritual personalities, and he was crucified, he was so powerful, he could have armed for a battalion and driven away all these Roman soldiers who were trying to beat him, drag him through the streets of Jerusalem, bearing the heavy cross on his shoulders. He didn't do that. Buddha died of eating meat, which was poisoned. So you find this throughout in the history of spiritual literature. Now, the difference is how they look upon all these things. Because Vedantins are convinced this body is there. The body is only an instrument. And there is a higher spiritual truth within. And that spiritual truth, Atman, reflects through this body. Mirror will not be there all the time. But sun is there all the time. If the mirror is broken, we don't say the sun has vanished. Sun remains. So, here is his description. Bhoge roga bhayam. And then kule chudi bhayam. If you are born in a very big aristocratic well-known family, you will be scary of losing the prestige. Bad name. Vitte nrupala chorad bhayam. You know, if you are a very rich man, the government may take all the money by over taxation. In ancient times, kings used to confiscate the wealth of many rich people, or thieves will steal. Shastrayavadi bhai, if you are a very learned person, you will be always looking for somebody who is more learned. So that creates a lot of problems. And gune khala bhayam, kai kudantad bhayam, if you have got a healthy body, one day I may fall sick, I may die. So, sarvam vastu bhayanvidam bhuvindranam vairagyameva bhayam. So, there is always an unpredictable risk or some unknown, unpleasant thing that could happen. So, people are always afraid at the physical, empirical level. But the moment we link ourselves to this higher, transcendental spiritual truth, then this fear is gone. And the greatest fear is the fear of death. Death itself is not something scary. It is nothing, it is just a coma or a transition point. It's a semicolon in our life. If we do our best in this life, we accumulate a huge wealth of spiritual capital. So in the next life, we'll be born, we'll inherit this huge spiritual wealth. And will continue our spiritual journey. So Vedanta is the science and philosophy of eternal, perennial optimism and hope. That's the uniqueness of Vedanta. Now the next subject is, how do we turn ourselves to Karma Yoga from this stage? So we are faced with the reality of the imperishable nature of Atman, the transcendental spiritual truth, the perishable nature of this body, the non-eternal nature of worldly comforts. Now, how do we connect ourselves with the ideal of Karma Yoga? For that, there are many verses in the Bhagavad Gita. I mentioned to you earlier, Bhagavad Gita is in a way a commentary on the first two verses of the Isavasya Upanishad. Isavasya Upanishad, in his first and second line of the first verse, expounds the highest spiritual truth. And the second verse, it also expounds how to practice this highest spiritual truth in our everyday activity. Not when we read philosophy or meditate, but even when we are working in the office, when we are doing our duties and responsibilities, whether you are a sage or an householder, you are a housewife or a professor, you are a student, whatever it may be, all our actions can be spiritualized. So that line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual vanishes. The secular becomes spiritual. The distinction vanishes. There is a famous verse in the Gita, quite a few verses. Yat karoshi, yat asnasi, yat jigoshi, dadasi, yat Yat tapasyati kaundeya tat kurusham adarpanam. The latter one deals with the act of offering, making an offering of whatever we do to the Lord. The first one is yat karoshi, whatever you do. Yat asnasi literally means whatever you eat. It only means even the act of eating food is a spiritual sacrament. It's called yajna. So whatever we do, then given example is given, even the act of eating food is as important, as much a spiritual practice, as the act of placing a flower at the feet of the Lord, or making an offering in the temple or a church or any spiritual place. And whatever you give. So, if we can look upon all of physical, verbal, intellectual activities, psychological, mental activities, if we can look upon them as an offering, then there is no action but only offering. So, with every act, the God idea comes. I still remember one great monk whom I knew very well for almost 25-30 years. He was the president of a center, and he built up a beautiful temple, and he didn't have many assistants with him. So apparently, in India you have to supervise your workers, not like here. You give a contract to somebody, then it works over. But there, you have to supervise sometimes, 20, 30 years back. So he used to be very active going about supervising how they put bricks and marble when constructing the temple and all these places. So nobody thought that he was a great spiritual seeker. There was nothing apparent about him. But very often people noticed that he has right hand in his pocket, in the pocket of his shirt. And frequently you could see him talking in strong language, scolding the workers for not doing the work properly, and so on. But once he retired, he was in a state of perfect calmness because he became too old, and he never interfered with the activities administration. He spent the rest of his lifetime either taking rest, reading scriptures, or meditation, or taking the name of God. So people used to wonder, how could he do that? The point was, his right hand was instead in the pocket of his shirt, and he was taking the name of God in Japamala. And then we'll be going about all this work. So when he was practicing karma yoga. When karma stopped, yoga remained. So that's why he could live the rest of his lifetime in perfect calmness and peace and tranquility. So that's the advantage of practicing karma yoga. When we get old, we are not able to continue our activities due to old age, we don't complain. We don't have any irritation, because when karma or action stops, yoga doesn't stop. Yoga continues. That's the advantage of practicing karma yoga. On the other hand, if the yoga element is absent, and when there is only karma, when the karma stopped at old age, either there is a huge vacuum in the mind. So mind becomes restless. Mind cannot keep quiet. Mind will not be able to enjoy any tranquility or peace. So that is the advantage of karma yoga. So as in this verse, Gita verse, whatever you do, and then whether you are eating food, serving, doing whatever it is, you can make it karma yoga. Now, we should remember one important point. Sometimes our mind plays tricks. You can find this phenomenon. It's a very psychological phenomenon in the most graphic style in the writings of St. Teresa of Avila, where she looks back in a very subjective way, trying to analyze the workings of her own mind. Of course, she puts a lot of blame on the doors of the devil. But in Vedanta literature, they try to analyze it from the psychological point of view. Both are two different approaches, equally valid, equally spiritually equally important. Sometimes our mind may play a trick. We may do things with great attachment, selfish pride, and a lot of competition, combativeness may be there. And then we may say, this is karma yoga. Now there is a contradiction, If there is yoga, then there will be no irritation, there will be no conflict. We may have to disagree with others, but even that disagreement will not be colored by hatred or jealousy or anything that will upset our mental balance. That's the main line of difference. Sometimes mind may play tricks. After doing everything, we say, well, I have done my duty, my karma yoga. The karma yoga aspect should be kept in mind, not only after having done the work, but also at the time of doing work. Because when we do that work, then we feel it's like floating in a river, on a river, without much effort. We'll be able to do our best. At the same time, we will feel that there's a divine plan and divine hand behind whatever we do. So this gives us a kind of inner blissfulness, inner fulfillment. In fact, that's what really keeps our devotees working calm for Vedanta societies. Psychologically, there's an explanation. Why do people come to temples, churches, Vedanta societies, highly placed professionals, people engage in different activities, They do things which they would not have done in their own homes. They take leave sometimes, losing salary, and clean the pavement, working all sorts of even menial things. People do with great dedication, with a great application. There is a psychological explanation. Because they are doing it without expecting anything, they get something, they get back something much greater, much more precious than money or anything else. Something that money cannot buy. So whenever we do some noble, unselfish deed, it produces what I said yesterday, an invisible potency in the system. And this could be in the form of a kind of inner soothing experience, a feeling of fulfillment, inner completeness. When we do something noble, even after that action is over, something else remains in the mind, a feeling of inner fulfillment, inner completeness. We may not even get back gratitude. Sometimes we get the opposite of gratitude. But then once we get this inner fulfillment, then the lack of gratitude will not irritate us. Otherwise, you do everything, you get not only gratitude, but it's opposite. It will upset anyone. But once we do as karma yoga, then we get back something in return, which is much more precious than gratitude. What is that? Something that a billionaire may not be able to afford, because it's not available in Trader Joe's. It is something that comes from within. So this is the first sign of a karma yogi. That's why karma yoga and also bhakti yoga. Because Lord Krishna says, Santushta Sadadam Yogini. Santushta is an inner contentment. Another name is Prasada. Our called Chitta Prasada. It comes in yoga also. The Prasada is a word that's very difficult to translate. Chitta Prasada. It is a kind of soothing feeling of inner fulfillment, inner completeness. When we get it, we cannot explain it, but that will keep us moving forward. It's a fuel that enables every spiritual seeker to go ahead. Otherwise, why should they personalize this? The same, there is a sentence of Avila. She had to face a lot of problems. How do you explain this mystery of great saints and sages? But to go through a lot of difficulties. How are they able to go ahead? Because there is no incentive. From a purely empirical point of view, you should get promotion. You should get some incentive. You should get an offer to go to Hawaii every year, 1 month, something like that. Some people get incentives. Here, nothing. Only trouble. From an empirical point of view, there is nothing enjoyable in it. And still you take all the trouble to go ahead. How are we able to do that? This Chitta Prasada is actually being produced. It is not easy to explain it. And now, a karma yogi is able to continue his karma yoga because the moment we start practicing karma yoga, it starts producing this Chitta Prasada. As I said, it is beyond definition, beyond description, beyond explanation. So, I have observed, without naming anybody, I can say, people go on working under circumstances and situations that are not very pleasant. I can tell you this, Swami Trignadidananda. He came to San Francisco in 1903 beginning, and he passed away in 1915 January. So, in less than 13 years, what we are all standing on his shoulders now. We are only 2 feet tall. Right now we feel we are 8 feet, but 6 feet belongs to him. Our height is only 2 feet. The point is, how could he do that? Of course, I am giving an extraordinary example. When he came, he said, it's a living example. You get any great spiritual seeker. How are they able, where do they get this energy? What enables them to go ahead? And you know, there is absolutely no incentive from an empirical point of view. Nothing. Yeah. The opposite of it. I said going in, either they should be mad, or there should be a divine result that is being produced. Something that keeps them going. What is that? In its most, in its grossest dimension, it is called Chitta Prasada. So if you want to test whether you are a karma yogi or not, at the subjective level, the best way to test ourselves, after doing this, I'm not getting anything, no money, no incentive, no promotion, no holidays. Still, I feel like going ahead, going forward. Why? Because something else is being produced. And that is a spiritual property, a spiritual commodity. It is called Chitta Prasada. So, that's the first sign of karma yoga. So Lord Krishna says, Kayena vacha manasindriva buddhyatmanava ansudasabhavat karodi yadyat sagalam parasmai narayana yadi samarpitat. It's exactly what Ishavasya Upanishad says, kurvanneva iha karmani jivisheshatam samnaha, the second verse. Living this world for 100 years, doing work as karma yoga. So it says, you know, kayena, means by physically, vacha, in words, manasa, mentally, thoughts, words, physically. Sometimes, you know, some people are very, you know, there are different ways of mind playing tricks. I'm very straightforward. So, if people are irritated, it's none of my business. You find such expression. I mean, well, they are not performing karma yoga verbally. Because if karma yoga should be, if you should be able to practice karma yoga verbally at the level of speech, we should be able to practice it at the mental level, at the thought level. So manasa, vacha, kayena. Kayena means the physical level, the mental level, thought level, and verbally. And you know, then indriya. Indriya he means what? Through the senses. And a much more important element is given, anusruta svabhava. You know anusruta svabhava. Actually anusruta svabhava means, it's like a flow. What we do in spite of ourselves, our natural, spontaneous, instinctive thought currents, words and activities. See, one can act very well and get a Nobel Prize, maybe Oscar, whatever maybe. So, in real life, our natural character should come out as karma yoga. As I mentioned some time back, you know, mind has got various layers. The more the number of layers, the more difficult it is to practice karma yoga. The less the number of layers, the more easy it is. Now, if a person is trying to practice karma yoga at the physical level, that is kayena, vacha means verbally, then at the thought level, manasa, then indriya, at the level of indriyas mean senses of action, senses of perception, and also at the natural instinctive level, it means what? We should be able to practice karma yoga instinctively in an effortless way, because wherever there is an effort involved, there is an element of duplicity. So the greatest masters of literature or painting are able to produce their masterpieces in an effortless, spontaneous, natural way. If you work hard every day for 10 hours, you work and you are going to write a poem or a novel, nobody is going to read it. It will be like a carpenter making a table or a chair, working hard, polishing, please don't mind, I mean. I'm not talking about any professionalism. But you know, maybe in earlier times when you don't have machinery, carpenter has to go to the forest, cut the trees, bring it home, and then he has to use primitive tools, chiseling, cutting, polishing, working hard for several years to produce a chair or a table. Like that, you cannot produce a masterpiece. If you work hard like that, like a military barracks, every day, 10 hours, you write an hour, 20, nobody is going to read it. It's not going to be masterpiece. The greatest masters could produce the masterpieces, because nature itself turned them into its instruments. Nature worked through them. They became natural instruments in the hands of nature. And then a great masterpiece, whether in music or in literature or in any field, is produced. It is called, you know, anusruta svabhava means ayatna leda, in an effortless, instinctive level. At the instinctive level, at the level of spontaneity, natural, effortless level, we should be able to practice action without desire. That's anusruta svabhava. It's very difficult to reach. So Lord Krishna says, kayena, physically, vacha, verbally, manasa means the thought level, then indriya, he means the sensory perception, the senses of action, senses of perception, and also, you know, buddhya, the intellectual level, atmana, spiritual level, and again, anusruta svabhava means a natural, spontaneous, effortless, instinctive level, we should be able to practice action with great concentration, shraddha, but minus attachment. karoti yadyat sagalam parasmai narayanaya iti samarpayetat. Now, to be able to do that, we need a focus. As I said earlier, we need a focus. We need a target. We need some idea. What is that? The idea cannot be the ideal of perfectionism, because the highest suicide rates are reported in perfectionist society. Japan, Holland, Sweden, some of the most advanced countries with total welfare state systems, education from cradle to grave, they report highest rates of suicides. So perfectionism at the empirical level will not guarantee this karma yoga idea. For that we need a transcendental focus. So Gita says Narayanaya means what? To God. One should be able to offer this to somebody. That somebody should be a high transcendental spiritual idea. It is offering to God. Once we offer to God, well, you know what happens? Everything gets regulated. Otherwise, there is a great danger which I was mentioning some time back. There's a verse in Sanskrit. It comes in one of the ancient dramas. It's a part of a dialogue. The verse is Yapuman Atimedhavi Chaturnam Ekamasmali Alpayu Anabatyova Daridra Padidopiva. This is an interesting and very relevant verse. Atimedhavi means a person of extraordinary intellectual powers and skills. Let us say geniuses, people who make great contributions to science, music, literature, many things. Now, if you want to become such an accomplished person, then you must devote your whole mental energies on one focus. Then only you can become an Einstein. I shall deal with physics only for 4 hours of the day, you are not going to become an Einstein. And Newton had to keep thinking of what he was doing all his lifetime, to the point of becoming half crazy. Example. You find great musicians, because they live in the world of music, then only they can become extremely gifted. They become outstanding. Otherwise, they become great musicians. But to become outstanding in any area, you need to focus all the energy, all the resources, mental, intellectual resources, in one direction. Then you can make a great contribution. But at a great price. That's this verse. Very frequently, but not always, please remember, not always, but in very many cases, extraordinarily gifted musicians, artists, have one problem. There is another side. When the pendulum moves in one direction, it doesn't come to the center, it goes the other direction. So they become perverted, sometimes they take to alcoholism, addiction and many such problems. Why? At the empirical level, if you try to accept yourself and if you drive all the energy resources in one direction, it comes at a price. You may be able to make a great contribution, but if you do not have a spiritual ideal, what happens, you know? Mind cannot remain at that level. So, the higher you fly, the lower you fall. The pendulum will naturally swing in the opposite direction. Not in all cases, but in very many cases. So, this verse says, so any person who doesn't have a spiritual focus, who may not have a high transcendental spiritual ideal, and who is extremely gifted, what happens? Either he may become short-lived, alpine, or he may very often, you know, he may, of course, this is an old ancient traditional verse, so you need not take it fully in literary sense, but it just got a great message. Anapatya means those who are childless, or, you know, they have one of these 4 great problems, or they may be poor, because they may not be able to concentrate on things of this world, they may become impractical, they may fail. Or we know what happens, no, they may have a deviation, fall. So what's the solution? Even in the midst of all extraordinary faculties and abilities, we must somehow try to link ourselves to a transcendental spiritual idea. Because that will have a regulating, disciplining effect in the whole system of mental life, thoughts, actions and ideas. This is not an absolute principle, what I mentioned, this loka. But in many, many cases, this happens, it has happened. So this verse says, even when you are extremely gifted, when you are highly accomplished to the point of making a unique contribution in any chosen profession or area of research, there should be some link, a link to some higher spiritual idea. Because once we are linked to that, then all other activities become regulated and will be established in a state of equilibrium. Otherwise, it's like a boat, it will be tilting in one direction. So that's the problem. Anyway, the discussion will continue tomorrow. We will have interaction. So we have got, I think, almost 25 minutes.
Excuse me, Swami. How can we extend that discussion of balance and focus on the ideal, not only in the natural expression of those gifts, but in our spiritual practices as well?
Yeah, you know, in fact, then if you can keep you focus on the transcendental spiritual idea, it doesn't take your mind away from your chosen profession. Rather, the distractions and dissipations are natural in the absence of a spiritual transcendental life. Focus will be reduced. You will be able to focus our energy resources in a state of perfect equilibrium calmness. Otherwise, it's like a boat tilting in one direction. Maybe it capsizes. Because the problem is, you know, our mind is, you know, the definition of mind in Vedanta is, you know, sankalpa vikalpa miga antakarna vritti mana. Mind is defined as a function of mental thought currents, impressions and samskaras, which are not uniform in nature. The mutually conflicting thought currents flashing through the mind. It's more like the mental lives. You find William James, many of them have tried to explain mind in some similar terms. Stream consciousness. So these thought currents, not uniform thought currents, but mutually contradictory, conflicting thought currents. One coming after another. This is what mind is, sankalpa and vikalpa. One set of thought currents and coming first, and another set of thought currents coming later. Now, suppose you try to focus the whole thing in one direction. The mind will look for an opportunity to move the opposite extreme. The pendulum doesn't come to the center and stop there. It will not stop till it reaches the other extreme. Because the momentum of focusing the mind and mental energies in one area will force the mind to move with equal speed to its opposite direction. So that is why many people who accomplish great things in music, art and literature, you cannot call them upper six or upper three. Remember, it doesn't happen in all cases, but it does happen in very many cases. You should not mention every artist should not think that way. It happens in very many cases. Girishchandra Ghosh is the most classical example. You know, we can read Girishchandra Ghosh. He was genius. But he got a focus in Sri Ramakrishna. He got himself linked to a spiritual ideal, and then he became completely saved. he himself says. So, of course, it is only one example. You can find several examples throughout the history of art, music, and so on. So the point, you know, mind cannot stop moving unless it reaches the opposite extreme point. It swings in the opposite direction. And pendulum reaches that end. So how to stop the pendulum from reaching that end? How to do that? It needs an intermediary focus. And it's spiritual. Which goes beyond both the directions. Both the ends. So once our mind is focused, linked to spiritual idea, then our energy, the way we spend our time, our efforts, get a spiritual direction, a kind of sublimation, refinement. Then becomes a protective, constructive source. Otherwise, it becomes constructive because it helps you to produce a masterpiece. It becomes destructive because it drives you the opposite direction. That's right. Please. First question, then I answer the next question. I have to remember, you can write down somewhere.
Yes. This is just what I heard. The Parikshit story, when it starts.
Parikshit story.
Yeah. It is said that that is like a transition of Kali Yuga, and Kali is actually taking control of the emotions of King Parikshit. That actually influenced him to become angry, even though he is a very, you know, good man. Is it something that
So in Parikshit's story, how Parikshit lost his balance and acted the way he did. The reason, according to mythological stories, that's the beginning of Kali Yuga. Well, that's one way of explaining it, you know. But you have to remember, even during the earlier Yuga, many people acted in identical ways. So, Puranas have got their own interpreting things at the beginning of Kali Yuga. There are, in this Kali Yuga itself, there are many people who don't lose balance that way. So, it cannot be taken as an absolute principle. That mythological books have got one way of interpreting things, but in a context which is in a different cultural context, you cannot bring in this Kali Yuga transition element here. Because if you do that, then it loses universal psychological implication. The story has got a universal psychological implication that goes beyond, far beyond its immediate cultural context or mythological background. That's got a great universal spiritual significance. So we must keep it at that level. Second question. That's true. Both are right. Prakrite Subhava. So, Kayena Vacha Manasindriva Buddhyatmanava Anusata Subhava. Prakrite Subhava. You know, when I tell it just means see. Prakriti means what? In Sanskrit, Prakriti means our natural nature. So, Prakashena Kriyadehi Prakriti means actually it is our natural, inherited, spontaneous nature. Ansuda means the same. So both are equally meaningful and relevant. That's all. Prakriti Subhava you find Bhagavad Gurana. But in Bhagavad Gita it is all mostly Ansuda Subhava. Of course it could interchange. In fact, the same verse occurs in Bhagavad Gurana and occurs in Bhagavad Gita also. There is an interchange. What we call in Sanskrit Padaveda means a different version, different readings. Doesn't make any difference. Yeah, see. It's a later work. So, any work that's of later, later period, we don't refer to. We refer to the authentic earlier works. Any other questions?
There are several musicians here at the retreat, and the concept, and I think I know what you mean, about the wholeness, feeling that wholeness coming into yourself.
Yeah.
Maybe a better option if you're a musician who
is very
sensitive
or very nervous. Yeah.
Or rather than trying to go for the highest of bliss.
Yeah. Yeah, you are right.
Does that make sense to you?
It makes
because
complete sense.
Because when the pendulum swings and you fall, it's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the point of discussion is this. Instead of linking also the transcendental ideal, if we can look for this inner fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
No, inner fulfillment ideal naturally comes in any spiritual music. Any music which has a spiritual content,
it
automatically comes. But in, see, there are many areas of music without much spiritual content. There also, you may reach perfection and you may feel a kind of inner contentment of reaching perfection. I didn't say it inevitably happens, but I said it frequently happens. So every area of music can be a royal highway that takes you the highest spiritual experience.
Yeah.
Music is the royal highway. The music is perhaps the most obvious one because music itself has produced many great spiritual seekers and teachers. So the whole point is, in the Karma Yoga ideal, we look for what I mentioned earlier, the prasada, inner prasada, I mean the inner fulfillment, contentment. If it comes, it only means that you have a higher focus. We may think that, well, without verbally dedicating all my efforts to God, in the formal sense, conventional sense of the term, I am enjoying this inner contentment. But actually, this inner contentment itself shows that you have a higher transcendental focus. It need not necessarily in the form of making an offering to a particular deity or a particular monotheistic god idea. It could take in a much more vague form also. So even if you look at music as something beyond an empirical thing, you look at it from a transcendental perspective, spiritual perspective, immediately becomes a higher focus. And then at the subjective level, you feel the inner contentment. This is fuel that keeps you going higher and higher. At the objective level, reaches a very high level of perfection. And not only that, there's another important element. That music inspires others. That music has got another important element. It inspires others. It moves human hearts. So why? Because it comes from a higher source. So remember, God idea doesn't mean somebody sitting in the sky. It means the inner spiritual divine spark within us. So when that connects with the same inner divine spark in others, that connection is called inspiration. That's what it's called. That's why you don't forget some musical conversations. So in the Gospel, Sri Ramakrishna refers to some ancient, not very ancient, but 18th century or 18th century devotional singers, and Sri Ramakrishna himself sings those devotional songs, and he forgets himself, he reaches samadhi. There is another aspect. Those composers, musicians, were themselves great devotees. So you can see the Atman to Atman connection. Among higher spiritual seekers, you may call it that way. At the ordinary plane, it's called inspiration. Inspiration is a transcendental phenomenon. It's a trans-empirical
phenomenon. And there are so many composers that we can feel that Atman to
Atman
relationship. I was thinking about Bach, the musicians who are here today know very well. And he would dedicate his music to the glory of God.
Yeah.
And when we hear Bach today, we can feel that inner contentment
and
that
joyousness of knowing the presence of God.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think, you know, just what you said is so helpful.
Yeah, yeah. I used to feel, though I don't understand the meaning, I used to feel the same thing when they sing Christmas Carol in the new temple.
Yes, yes.
Many of the compositions coming from earlier centuries, we could feel, though, you know, I mean, we don't fully understand the grammar of music, you know. But this higher Atman to Atman link goes beyond the grammar of music.
Yes.
So, that's right. That itself is a proof that Atman is immanent and omnipresent.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Well, you feel that Bach would completely understand that idea that everything is covered by the Lord.
Yes.
You know, that we're studying in the Isha, Upanishad.
Yeah.
He would get it right away.
Yeah.
He knew it.
You step beyond the empirical, then this is what you experience. That's all. At the empirical level, we may not, but just one step beyond the empirical, this is what you experience. Yeah. So, any more discussion? Otherwise, we'll continue the discussion tomorrow. Yes. Doctor, anything, Doctor? We can discuss? Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ram Krishna.